Peace, everybody. Thanks for coming out to this awesome reading. It's that tight. We were talking during the break about the complications that Brian Turner presented to me introducing him, because Brian's a friend of mine, and I admire his work. But the first time I met Brian was right after he'd come back from Iraq. And it wasn't that it's obviously something that affected him. But more than that, he just showed himself to be really willing to drink with me in a way that lent itself to the kind of stories that don't really work as introductions. But I've got to say this, because when Stacy and I got married, Brian was there for me when the beer ran out, and he and I trudged in the Oregon rain uphill both ways to buy a couple of cases of Tecate, right? Because it was the only thing that the gas station sold. And there's Brian. He's like, "I'll do it with you, man. Let's go." And it's like I understand from his book and from lots of other things that Brian is a very sincere and dedicated person. But that's the most gung-ho I've ever heard him was when with beer was involved. So rather than diminish this astounding book that Brian's written, or the things that went on in the process of creating this book, I wrote sort of a formal thing. So I'm going to read that, and hopefully it'll do justice to Brian's book. In 2005, the year Brian Turner's Here Bullet won the Beatrice Holly Prize, the United States was in its third year of the Iraq War. By that year, more than 1,500 U.S. soldiers had been killed, and in W.'s own words, there were 30,000 more or less, 30,000 more or less Iraqi casualties. The disagreement with W's policies was loud and was getting louder, and I was hollering, and my friends were hollering, and Stacy and I were hoping that Brian, was going to make it through then and after. Into this hubbub came Here Bullet, a first-person poetic account of what it means to be a U.S. soldier in Iraq. Much like the British poets in World War I, Turner's poems do not make judgments on the policies of the government. Rather, they make observations about the humanity, or more realistically, the lack of humanity, inherent in war. Part of this unique critique stems from the fact that, unlike those WW1 poets, or WW2 poets, or Vietnam poets, or any other war poets that I'm familiar with, Brian Turner wrote the poems in Here Bullet while he was still in Iraq. The poems that are in this book were written and predominantly emailed to Stacy, kept in good faith until Brian came back to the United States, and then turned into what you hopefully have a copy of there, and what we're going to hear some of from Brian tonight. He'd write the poems after going out on patrol or doing any of the many other dangerous and arduous things that these soldiers do, and then would email them in bunches to Stacy, hoping that they wouldn't be his last testament. I really need you to think about that when you think about his poems, because there's a necessity in those poems that doesn't exist usually in poetry. Poetry is not life or death, no matter how much we think it is. But Brian's poems actually are, and that's a very complicated dynamic. As a result, the poems in this book are immediate, bewildering, and forceful in a way that only comes from the trauma of human experience. Brian also has a new book coming out in 2010, called Talking the Guns. Is that right? Okay, never mind, scratch that. He's debating the title, and it's going to be coming out soon, and I'm very excited to hear that. Hopefully he'll read some from that, too. Please welcome Brian Turner.
So how are you guys doing tonight? We're at a bar, I don't really ever get to read at a bar, You can get a beer and stuff. You guys cool with this poetry stuff? Right on, man. I'm just going to jump in and read some poems. So. The 107s have a crackling sound of fire and electricity, of air-ruckled heat. And when they pinwheel over the rooftops of Haman al-Alil, they just keep going, traveling for years over the horizon to land in the meridians of Divisadero Street, where I'm standing early one morning in the meridians of Divisadero Street, where I'm standing early one morning on a Memorial Day in Fresno, California, the veterans parade scattering at the impact, mothers shielding their children by instinct, old war vets crouching behind automobiles as police set up an outer cordon for the unexploded ordnance. Rockets often fall in the night sky of the skull, down long avenues of the brain's myelin sheathing, over synapses and the rough structures of thought, they fall into the hippocampus, into the seat of memory, where lovers and strangers and old friends entertain themselves, unaware of the dangers headed their way, or that I will need to search among them the way the bomb disposal tech walks tethered and alone down Divisadero Street, suited up as if walking on the moon's surface, as a crowd watches just how determined he is to dismantle death, to take it apart piece by piece, the bravest thing I've ever seen. So what the hell is that all about, right? In August of 2004, I was up in Mosul at the time. I'll give you a little bit. We went into Kuwait. We weren't the first initial invasion unit, but we were sort of practicing and getting ready in the desert, getting all our gear and stuff, cleaning it up, re-zeroing our weapons. And then on the 3rd of December, 2003, we crossed the border into Iraq. And as a short story, or a little interlude, as we were lined up and we were driving, we were still in Kuwait. One of the sergeants in the convoy, there was a van that pulled in, a Kuwaiti van trying to get to work or something, and pop, pop, he shot into the engine block. Because that's how, like, tense people were, you know? We all pulled over, and the colonel went over the battalion net and said, hey, we are not at war with the Kuwaitis, you know? Hold on, you know? That's how amped up people sort of were. We drove up Highway 1 past Baghdad to a small town called Balad, which is just off the Tigris River, about an hour's drive north of Baghdad. We stayed there for a few months. Then we moved up to Mosul, or Mosul, the locals say it both ways. We stayed there for a few more months, and then the spring of 2004, there was an uprising where a lot of the bridges and roadways were blown in the middle of the country. And so my company was sent south, and then I rejoined them after coming home for a couple of weeks of leave, where I saw Stacy for a bit, kind of made my head a little bit straighter, you know, for a bit. And that was cool. Thank you for, you know, showing me some sanity. And my friend Brian, I saw him at the same time as well. He took the photo that's on the back cover of the book. We went up to the mountains. He's a photographer and stuff. And then I went back to Iraq, which was a very odd process. And I want to say one little thing. Do you mind? I should just read poems, but Stacey reminded me tonight, because I forgot about this. I don't really remember this, but thankfully she does. And you probably do. And I don't know how this works. I'm pointing to Adrian back here. But she said that when I was walking around, I was still scanning the rooftops and stuff and down the street for snipers and stuff. And then what did I say that I... Yeah. So you probably couldn't hear that back there. She said I'd said the worst thing I could do is get comfortable here and not keep doing my job, so because I have to go back there, you know, to keep this sort of mental process going. That's just bizarre to me. I don't even remember that, though, you know. But when I did go back, I joined my unit. They were south in Baghdad. We'd been pulled from Mosul south. And we were living north and south of the city. And daily what we would do is ferry or like convoy escort. These 90 or so 18-wheelers would get, they call it a loggerhead, and then we would get in between the vehicles and drive them through the city. And at that time, we were ordered at one point, we said that you are authorized to shoot children. I remember hearing that on the radio. It was pretty bad for, you know. And I don't know, the poems say it better. Brian said it's pretty bad, but I think the poems, I can actually say it there. And we stayed there for a couple of more months, and then we moved back up to Mosul in the north and finished out our time there, signed our weapons and stuff over to the next unit, and then flew home. So that's a skeletal timeline of what we did, but hopefully the poems will sort of flesh out more of what was happening there. So, AB negative, the surgeon's poem. Thalia Fields lies under a gray ceiling of clouds, just under the turbulence, with anesthetics dripping from an IV into her arm. And the flight surgeon says the shrapnel cauterizes it, traveled through her, here, breaking this rib as it entered, burning a hole through the left lung to finish in her back. And all of this she doesn't hear, except perhaps as music, that faraway music of people's voices when they speak gently and with care, a comfort to her on a stretcher in a flying hospital en route to Landstuhl, just under the rain at midnight. And Thalia drifts in and out of consciousness as a nurse dabs her lips with a moist towel, her palm on Thalia's forehead, her vitals slipping some, as burned flesh gives way to the heat of blood, the tunnels within opening to fill her, just enough blood to cough up and drown in. Thalia sees shadows of people working to save her, but cannot feel their hands, cannot hear them any longer. And when she closes her eyes, the most beautiful colors rise in darkness, tangerine washing into Russian blue, with a droning engine humming on and a dragonfly's wings, island palms painting the sky an impossible hue with their thick brushes dripping green, which is a way of dealing with the fact that Thalia Fields is gone, long gone, about as far from Mississippi as she can get. 10,000 feet above Iraq, with a blanket draped over her body and an exhausted surgeon in tears, his bloodied hands on her chest, his head sunk down, the nurse guiding him to a nearby seat and holding him as he cries, though no one can hear it, because nothing can be heard where pilots fly in blackout, the plane like a shadow guiding the rain, here in the droning engines of midnight. I read that at the Virginia Military Institute. Afterwards, a gentleman came up from, what's that? You know, I got to apologize because, thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, it's tough because tonight, you know, I sometimes, read. What do I have to work with here, you know? That's the sad thing because it continues, you know? And like a lot of poets, you know, you come in and you try to modulate. Yeah. And you got to try to modulate and have some humor and some, you know, different types of things going on. But it doesn't happen. It's just like, this sucks and this is hard and this is difficult and it continues on, you know? Well, hold on to your hat, all right? Because it's tough. This one, if that one was tough, this one's tough. Yeah. But I do want to say that Thalia Fields, when that name is made up, that wasn't her real name. But oddly, I came up with the name of a poet back here in America who's Thalia Field. I didn't even know that. I made up a name, so I was still tapped into poetry somehow, you know? But he came up to me and he said that when the battalion colonel came up out of this audience, and I didn't know him. He was dressed in civilian clothes. And he introduced himself and said, oh, that was about so-and-so, who, right? And it was the right name. I was like, yeah, because it talks about these island palms painting in sky and impossible hue, this sort of active imagination stuff. I have no clue what she went through during that time, you know? But he said the last words that she said as he put him on the bird that took her off to launch duel was, she said, go get those bastards, you know? And I'll share this with you. I read that at West Point, and I said the same story. And unlike there, I don't see at West Point, because those are like cool Hollywood lines, you know what I mean? People get paid good money to write a line like, go get those bastards, you know, as they put them on the plane and stuff, you know? And at West Point, I remember seeing some of the cadets like, yeah, you know, because that's they're young, and that's how they want to go out or something. But I told them, I said, imagine those are the last words of your life. That's the note that you go out on, you know? 2,000 pounds. It begins simply with a fist, white-knuckled and tight, glossy with sweat, with two eyes and a rearview mirror watching for a convoy. The radio, a soundtrack that adrenaline has pushed into silence, replacing it with a heartbeat, his thumb trembling over the button. A flight of gold. That's what Cephalon thinks. As he lights a Miami, draws in the smoke, and waits in his taxi at the traffic circle. He thinks of summer, 1974, lifting pitchforks of grain high in the air, the slow drift of it like the fall of Shafa's hair. And although it was decades ago, he still loves her, remembers her standing at the canebrake where the buffalo cooled shoulder deep in the water, pleased with the orange cups of flowers he brought her. And he regrets how so much can go wrong in a life. How easily the years slip by, light as grain, bright as the street's concussion of metal, shrapnel traveling at the speed of sound to open him up in blood and shock, a man whose last thoughts are of love and wreckage with no one there to whisper him gone. Sergeant Ledoux, of the National Guard. He speaks but cannot hear the words coming out. And it's just as well his eardrums have ruptured, because it lends the world a certain calm. Though the traffic circle is filled with people running in panic, their legs a blur like horses in a carousel, turning and turning the way the tires spin on the Humvee flipped to its side. The gunner's hatch he was thrown from, a mystery to him now, a dark hole in metal the color of sand. If he could, he would crawl back inside of it. And though his fingertips scratch at the asphalt, he hasn't the strength to move. Shrapnel has torn into his ribcage, and he will bleed to death in minutes. But he finds himself surrounded by a strange beauty, the shine of light on the broken, a woman's hand touching his face tenderly the way his wife might, amazed to find a wedding ring on his crushed hand, the bright gold sinking in flesh, going to bone. Rashid passes the bridal shop on a bicycle with Sefa beside him. And just before the air ruckles and breaks, he glimpses the sidewalk reflections in the storefront glass, men and women walking and talking or not, an instant of clarity, just before each of them shatters under the detonation's wave, as if even the idea of them were being completely destroyed, stripped of form. The blast tearing into the mannequins who stood as though husband and wife a moment before, who cannot touch one another, who cannot kiss, who now lie together in glass and debris, holding one another in their half-armed embrace and calling this love, if this is all there will ever be. The civil affairs officer, Lieutenant Jackson, he stares at his missing hands, which make no sense to him. No sense at all. To wave these absurd stumps held in the air where just a moment before he'd blown bubbles out the Humvee window, his left hand holding the bottle, his right hand dipping the plastic ring in soap, filling the air behind them with floating spheres like the oxygen trails of deep ocean divers. Something for the children, something beautiful. Translucent globes with their iridescent skins drifting on vehicle exhaust and the breeze that might lift one day over the Zagros Mountains. That kind of hope. Small globes, which may have astonished someone on the sidewalk 7 minutes before Lieutenant Jackson blacks out from blood loss and shock, with no one there to bandage the wounds that would carry him all the way home. Nearby, an old woman cradles her grandson, rocking him on her knees as though singing him to sleep, her hands wet with their blood, her black dress soaked in it as her legs give out and she buckles with him to the ground. If you'd asked her 40 years earlier if she could see herself, an old woman begging by the roadside for money, with a bomb exploding at the market among all these people, she'd have said, to have your heart broken one last time before dying, to kiss a child given sight of a life he could never live, it's impossible. This isn't the way we die. And the man who triggered the button, who may have invoked the prophet's name or not, he is obliterated at the epicenter. He is everywhere. He is of all things. His touch is the air taken in, the blast and the wave, the electricity of shock. His is a sound the heart makes quick in the panic's rush, the surge of blood searching for light and color. That sound the martyr cries, filled with the word his soul is made of, Inshallah! But still hanging in the air over Asher Square, the telephone line snapped in two, crackling, a strange incantation the dead hear as they wander confused amongst one another, trying to learn each other's names, trying to comfort the living in their grief, to console those who cannot accept such random pain, speaking Habib softly, one to another there in the rubble and debris, Habib, over and over, that it might not be forgotten. Habib is a word for love, right? I didn't bring any water. I didn't bring anything to drink up here. What am I thinking? Yeah, give me 2 seconds. I'm just going to go.
No, you give me 2 seconds.
Keep me on my toes. Well, we're going to get there, but it's going to take a bit.
Yeah.
I'll do the best I can. Well, I think we need to. Yeah.
Yeah, true.
No. We're cool. We're all cool. Everybody's all right here. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Disrespected you. Shut up. No, you shut up.
How about this? I'll just read some poems and we'll all just
do that, all right? Okay. And we can be cool, and that way that, you know, we don't have to have any animosity started. No, I'm not asking to. I'm just saying, I'm going to read some poems. I'll read some poems, all right? It's true. That's true.
I love everybody.
All right. How about a sex poem? We'll mix it up, all right? We'll mix it up. All right. But I can't say it'll be cool, but I'll do what I can. All right? All right. Okay. All right. So. All right. Gotcha. And I'll buy you a drink afterwards, all right? Okay. Last night's dream. In the dream, her breasts become confused and my lips. I shoot an azimuth to her navel while her fingertips touch me with concussions, as if explosives rang through the nerves of my body, as if I am strung with wire, a huge receiver of UHF radio transmissions, frequency hopping with our tongues as we kiss, and I slide into her with a sound of flashbang grenades that make her eyes cloud over in smoke from the heat of it. In the dream, she kisses Arabic into my skin, and I understand every word of it. I transcribe it backwards into cuneiform and stone. I rename the arteries and veins for every river and wadi from Dohuk North to Basra South. I feel for this geography of pleasure. My tongue is a marker that writes even in the rain, even in salt and sweat, and I write with it now over every curve and turn of her body. In the dream, our orgasm destroys a nation. It leaves thermite and gunpowder in the air above us, a crackling of radio static as we kiss on, long into the denouement of skin and fire, where medevac helicopters fly in the dark caverns of our lungs in search of the wounded, and we breathe them, one to another, a deep rotor wash of pain and bandages. So that poem, I was in Iraq and I was writing this poem, right? But I wasn't thinking necessarily about me and some individual. You know, I was thinking more about we, the United States, and the intimacy created with Iraq. So I'll read just a couple lines from the end again, just to with that in mind. Where medevac helicopters fly in the dark caverns of our lungs in search of the wounded, and we breathe them one to another, a deep rotor wash of pain and bandages. There's many bandages needed this time, right? We have much work to do. We can forget, though. We can go, oh, shit, my wallet, right? The mortgage, you know, my mortgage, my stocks, my retirement stuff. And don't get me wrong. If I individually, or if any of us individually, if we don't pay attention to the minutiae of the detail which construct our own personal lives, then other than the people that are close to us, the rest of the world probably won't notice as it crumbles around us if we don't attend to these things, right? It's survival. These are parts of our modern day survival. But at the same time, it seems like we live in a culture that sometimes affords us free time. What do you do with that time? If we go over and we commit ourselves and we create a responsibility with the nation, how many dead? It was said, the President Bush early on said 30,000, and then it was updated later to 100,000 near the end of his time in office. And that was the official administration. Have you guys heard other figures? Because there's been different facts and figures. What's that? 600,000. The Lancet survey says between 420 and 790. It's a variable time. There's another survey I heard that says 1 million, and another one at 2 million. And I think those two include the first Gulf War and the sanctions in between with the infant mortality rate, that type of thing added in. But let's lowball it, right? Let's just go with the low figure, 100,000. My question is, what does it say about a country that can bury 100,000 people on the earth, take the last breath of their life, and really know nothing about them? You know? What does that say about us? I say this not as a finished thing. That can be said for historians in the future. But because it's still a process that's ongoing, we are still alive, and we can still attend to this as we can. What will you do? You know? What will you do? I read the last poem I wrote when I was in Iraq. It was when I was in a bunker that was a little bit bigger than the width of this room and about as long as this room. And about, you know, about the same as that room there. It was covered in sandbags, and we were at an air base, and we'd given our vehicles over to the outgoing unit, or the incoming unit, and we've given them bullets and stuff like that. We don't need the bullets. We're just trying to go home, right? And as we were there, a lot of guys were sleeping. And I say guys because the unit that I was in was all men in that unit, but there's tens of thousands of American women as well serving there. But in the particular unit I was in, these guys, it seemed like if you could sleep, the more you could sleep, the less time you were actually in Iraq, in a weird way, you know? And so a lot of them were sleeping. Other guys were like popping rip fuel and doing their last minute push-ups to have some whatever last bit of muscle they could have for their girlfriend back home, you know, so they could kind of strut their stuff or whatever. And then others were, you know, playing cards or reading a book, and I was writing this poem as if I was already on the plane taking off. And a side story, they were in chocks or groups. The group before us, I didn't know this. They didn't tell us this till we got home. But they got on the plane, they lifted off, and a surface-to-air missile fired, lodged into the fuselage, and then it did not explode. You know, they went out, emergency landed, got back on buses, came back and did it again. Wow. Like, man, those guys were brave, those men and women. But we were thinking about it, though, you know. So this poem is written, it's called Night in Blue, as if I'm already on the plane looking back. At 7,000 feet and looking back, running lights blacked out under the wings and America waiting. A year of my life disappears at midnight. The sky, a deep viridian. The house lights below, small as match heads burned down to embers. Has this year made me a better lover? Will I understand something of hardship, of loss? Will a lover sense this in my kiss or touch? What do I know of redemption or sacrifice? What will I have to say of the dead? That any of it made sense? I have no words to speak of war. I never dug the graves in Tel Afar. I never held the mother crying in Ramadi. I never lifted my friend's body when they carried him home. I have only the shadows under the leaves to take with me, the quiet of the desert, the low fog of Balad, orange groves with ice forming on the rinds of fruit. I have a woman crying in my ear late at night when the stars go dim. Moonlight and sand is a resonance of the dust of bones and nothing more. So are we cool? Read a few more poems? What are you guys thinking? Yeah? All right. It's quiet here. It's like, no clinking. Yeah, exactly. It's like the heart monitor or something, right? The whatever you... So I'm going to try to somehow segue, see if I can do this, towards new work that I'm writing for this next book. And I think I've changed my mind. I'm flip-flopping a little bit on this, but it was called Talk the Guns, but I think it's going to be called A Trauma Junkie's Delight. And, right? And, one of the poems, the very first poem of that book, is this one. And it's, I was in Fresno, that's where I'm from, right? And I went in, I was working on this project back home, and they needed some nails. So I went in, get some nails at Lowe's Home Improvement Center. And as I was walking, it's not like you can just get nails. I mean, there's that whole aisle, and you got to find the nails you need, you know what I mean? Which is cool and not cool at the same time. But as I was in there looking for what I needed, I came across these double-headed nails. They use them for scaffolding, you know? And if you get the right finish and the right size and stuff, it's a lot like the firing pin, almost identical to the firing pin that went in my weapon that I used to carry, you know? So I started looking around because it seemed like we were a country at war, but there was no war. Not in Fresno, at least. Seemed like, you know what I mean? I don't know if it feels like that in St. Louis. I mean, economically, it sure feels like it, looking around, just from a quick glimpse, you know? But at the same time, I started looking, and I thought, man, there's like imagistic rhymes, like those fan blades. Those are a lot like helicopter blades, you know, the rotors. So I went back in my car, got a notebook, and went back in the store and was writing down, like, taking notes for this, what became this poem. And guys were coming up to me like, hey, do you know how to do the plaster? And I'm like, dude, I'm a poet, man. Baffled, you know what I mean? They're like, what? You know, what are you doing here? You know, so writing this poem. It's called At Lowe's Home Improvement Center. Very little guys to that, G-U-I-S-E. Right? Standing in aisle 16, the hammer and anchor aisle, I stare at a 50-pound box of double-headed nails I've busted open by accident, their oily, bright shanks and diamond points reminding me of the firing pins from M4s and M16s. They pour onto the tile floor in a steady stream, constant as shells falling south of Baghdad last night. where Bosch kneeled under the chain guns of helicopters stationed above, their tracer fire a bizarre geometry of light. At dawn, when the shelling finally stops, hundreds of bandages will not be enough. And I'll repeat that, because that's directly from an email from Bosch, my old rifleman. At dawn, when the shelling finally stops, hundreds of bandages will not be enough. And later in that email, he said, and then on the American side, not a hangnail. You know? Two. Here comes Bosch down aisle 16 in full combat gear, improbable, worn out from fatigue, with a rifle slung at his side, his left hand guiding a 10-year-old boy who has seen what war is and will never rid it from his head. Here, Bosch says to me, take care of him. I'm going back in for more. Three. Sheets of plywood drop with the airy breath of mortars the moment they crack open in shrapnel. The retired couple in the lawn and garden department don't notice. Mower blades are just mower blades, and the Troy-built, self-propelled mower doesn't resemble a Blackhawk or an Apache. In fact, no one seems to notice the casualty collection center Doc High is marking out in ceiling fans, aisle 15. Wounded Iraqis with IVs sit propped up against boxes as 92 sample paradigms.